4. When he heard Alert 3 from the mine radio in his belt, Johnny had slid out of the coffin buried close by the platform and inside the atmosphere armor curtain. He was dressed in a camouflage radiation suit and wore an air mask under its face shield. His pouch was hanging from a wide belt. He was armed with 3 kill clubs, a dirk, and a flamethrower. He had a couple of other things for contingencies. He had not expected the Brigantes to be inside on the platform. 6 guards and General Sniff. He hadn't thought even a Brigante would be crazy enough to let himself be fired to Cyclo. Money. They had bundles of money on the platform. They were all looking at Turl. Turl was turning away from pushing the firing button. The Brigantes had not noticed Johnny 30 feet away and slightly behind them. Well, it would not matter. Johnny started to ignite the flamethrower. And then he saw a movement. They had something in a long bundle. The end of it was open. They had somebody there. A hostage they were taking to Cyclo? Gray hair. The scrap of a cloak. Sir Robert. Johnny had to abandon any thought of using the flamethrower. It would kill Sir Robert as well. Turl was walking easily and confidently back from the console to the platform center. The wires were humming. He halted, thunderstruck. Just a moment ago, he had seen what he had thought was the animal outside, way over by the car. And here he was, inside the armor curtain. Was the curtain off? No, he could see it shimmer through the snow. How had the animal gotten through it? Just as Turl was about to charge, he saw the animal drop a long rod weapon he carried. The animal's hand darted toward a pouch at his belt. Johnny withdrew the contracts Turl had signed. He skimmed them to the platform center, the red seals glaring in the falling snow. Unmistakably, the contracts Turl had signed. Johnny shouted as loud as he could to be heard through masks and faceplates, "Don't forget to record these on Cyclo!" Turl was horror-struck. The last thing he wanted to appear on Cyclo's platform were those phony contracts. Turl started to dive toward them and pick them up. He collided with Smith just as the general sought to give orders to his bowmen. Reaching down, Johnny picked up a beryllium ultimate bomb. He had intended to just throw it on the platform. It was wrapped with a cord. The golden glow of its metal, its size, and its hexagonal shape made it totally recognizable. The cord was not a fuse. The fuse was inside it set for 8 minutes by a timing device on the top. It had an access plate in the bottom that was purposely jammed. Johnny touched the igniter he still held to the carrying cord end. 2 poisoned arrows whizzed by him. "Grenade!" shouted Johnny. He pitched the 80-pound weight straight at Turl. It struck the Cyclo a glancing blow and bounced down under his feet. 1 glimpse of a lit grenade, their own favorite weapon, caused the Brigantes to run. At that moment, trumpeting elephants sounded outside. The Brigantes hit the atmosphere armor curtain and were thrown back from it. Turl took 1 look at the bomb, and any thought he had about papers fled as his horror turned into terror. It was the bomb. But it had a time fuse. How had the animal gotten it away from Brown Limper, unwrapped it, and changed the fuse all in no time at all? But Turl knew what he had to do. He had to get rid of it fast. He was about to pitch it off the platform when the Brigantes came thudding back in recoil off the curtain. He knew that if he threw it, the bomb would just bounce back. The wires were humming. Turl knew he had to get that access plate off and remove the core and do it fast. He could even see the time fuse closing. He crouched down and began to claw at the access plate in the bottom. It was stuck. He fought with it. Johnny sprinted past Turl. He had to get Sir Robert and get him over to the console. A Brigante was up on 1 knee. A poisoned arrow slapped past Johnny's head. Johnny dragged Sir Robert clear of the long case. His hands and feet were tied. Sir Robert was shouting something. Something like, "Leave me and save yourself!" All chaos had broken out beyond the curtain. There were Scott battle cries and the roar of stampeding elephants. Flames splashed against the other side of the atmosphere armor. The falling snow, even inside the platform, was converting to rain. Heat. Turl was clawing at the access plate. He had no annealing knife to cut the metal. He was trying to scrape a circle and cut it with his claws. He was bellowing in frustration and adding to the uproar. Two Brigantes charged Johnny. He let go of Sir Robert, snatched a kill club from his belt, and struck twice. They went down. He was able to drag Sir Robert a bit further. It was a long way to that console. Another Brigante was up. Johnny threw the kill club. It hit the mercenary's forehead, and his head went back at an incredible angle. Snith was up, shouting and pointing at Johnny. The din was deafening outside this cage. A Brigante tackled Johnny in the legs. Johnny got another kill club and smashed his brains out. He got Sir Robert a little further. The Scot was heavy. Snith was trying to get the last two of his guards to fire. Their bowstrings were too wet. They snatched out bayonets and charged. Johnny threw a kill club, and one Brigante was catapulted backward. The other came on. Johnny took his last kill club from his belt. He parried the bayonet and struck the Brigante alongside the head. The kill club flew out of his hand. He got Sir Robert a bit closer to the console. He was trying to pick Sir Robert up and carry him. For a moment, Johnny's back was turned. General Smith snatched a poison arrow out of his crossbelt and rushed. The heavy impact of the body hit Johnny's pouch. General Smith raised the poisoned arrow and drove it into Johnny's upper left arm, drove it in through the radiation suit and deep into the flesh. Johnny went down. He rolled, pulling a dirk. He came up and drove the knife into Smith's heart. The pain of the wound was savage. Johnny grasped the arrow shaft and pulled it straight out. But he knew the damage was done. The ferocious fire in the wound was almost more than he could bear. He gritted his teeth and rallied his strength. They had said it was a slow poison. He still might have time to save Sir Robert and the console. He grabbed the hilt of the knife and tried to yank it out of Smith's heart. It was stuck. He looked at Turl. The Cyclo, still raving, was clawing at the access plate. Tearing his claw points, he was actually cutting into the hard metal to make a circle and remove the core. It was quieter outside. Dwight's voice came out of the mine radio at his belt. 10 seconds to withdraw. Johnny knew he was late. The wires were still humming. Johnny made himself concentrate. He still had a job to do. He could feel his heart revving up. He got a hand under Sir Robert's armpit and dragged him through the slush. He got to the console. He knew it had a bomb in it he would have to disarm fast. But he tucked Sir Robert in close to the console so the dome coming down would not amputate his arms or legs. He glanced at the console. The switch was in the up position. It would have to be in the down position when next this was fired. He wished he had time to tell somebody. He fumbled for his remote control box. There was broken glass in his pouch. His arm felt like it was on fire. That broken glass was the serum ampule. He had no serum. The remote shook. No, it was his hand shaking. He threw the switch and swung the crane. No, he had to turn off the armor curtain first. He was getting flashes of blackness. His heart was beating faster and faster. The armor curtain. He crawled to the bus bar and got it off. Back at the console, he looked up at the dome. He operated the remote, positioning the dome exactly above them so it would come down correctly. He threw the switch to lower it. It was coming down too slowly. The cables must be stiff. He could not help that. He got a hatchet out of his belt for the cables. He would have to be ready to hack them off the instant the humming stopped. Johnny lost track of time. He could still hear the humming of the wires. He looked toward Turl over on the platform. The monster seemed to have succeeded in opening the access plate. He was handling the bomb with great care, extracting the heavy metal core. Suddenly, Johnny knew what Turl was going to do. He would throw that core at him. It would travel like a bullet. It could go straight through him. Abruptly, Johnny saw something else. Brown Limper. He was rushing forward with a Thompson submachine gun in his hands. He had gone through where the armor curtain had been at the far end of the platform. He was trying to get so close to Johnny he couldn't miss. The dome was not yet down. Turl had the core in his paw now. He was going to throw it at Johnny. It was quieter. There was only smoke and falling snow and the creak of the cables lowering the dome. Johnny pointed at Brown Limper. "Turl, he's going to shoot!" he shouted. Turl spun around and saw Brown Limper. He saw him raising the Thompson to aim it. One shot at this moment would shatter the firing. Turl threw. He threw with all his strength. The core hit Brown Limper in the side. It ripped through and hit his spine. The Thompson clattered to the ground. Brown Limper fell in a jerking tangle of arms and legs, screaming, "Damn you, Tyler! Damn you!" He lay still. The wires were still humming. Turl yelled at Johnny, "I still win, rat brain." He knew better than to move now. Johnny's head was pounding. His heart was going too fast. But he could shout back, and he felt he had to pin Turl there, distract him. "Those coffins are full of sawdust. They were changed in your bedroom this morning," shouted Johnny. Turl whirled to look at them. "And the gold never went to Cyclo. We changed those too," yelled Johnny. Turl opened his mouth to shout. The platform cargo shimmered. The coffins full of sawdust shimmered. The Brigante corpses on the platform shimmered. Turl shimmered. And it was all gone. The platform was empty. Clean even of slush. The humming stopped. Johnny took his hatchet and slammed the blade down across the cables. It wasn't a full severance. He struck twice more. All the cables parted. Things were going blacker. No, it was the dome. The reworked plane skids on the bottom of it hit the metal. Johnny reached out to the dome interior and pulled closed the locking lever which annealed them to the metal the console sat on. It was very dark. He felt his time sense must have gone out, and then a fleeting thought that maybe Turl had extended the time for his own firing. Johnny had had a small mine lamp in his pouch. He made an effort to reach it. His whole body was beginning to shake as if everything was drawn too taut. A voice was talking to him. It was Sir Robert.
"Hurry, cut my hands loose."
Johnny had the hatchet. He made himself feel about for Sir Robert's hands. The blade was dull. The cord was resistant. Then he remembered with a surge of panic, there must be a time bomb under that console. It would blow Sir Robert to bits. He dropped the hatchet and put his hand to the console's side. It was terribly heavy. He only had one working arm, but he put his agonizing shoulder against the metal. He got the bottom of the console lifted. He fished along the lower edges, then a little higher. He felt it. It was taped on. Working with one hand, he got it loose and pulled it out. He let the console tip back in place. In the dark, he extracted the fuse from it. Johnny felt he was going unconscious. His heart was revving up, faster and faster. He had one more thing to do. The switch. The position of the switch. Johnny felt like he was being torn to pieces by his nerves pulling tight.
"Sir Robert, tell them the switch... the switch has to be in a down position. A down position for the next..."
The outside of the dome was struck a blow so hard the whole platform rocked. It was as though a dozen earthquakes had hit at once. As though the planet had been torn apart. Johnny stiffened out into blackness. He no longer heard the chaos going on outside. 5. About an hour before the firing, the orbiting group of ships had just come over the horizon that put them into position to view the American compound. A small Hovind spy craft in the orbit ahead of them had already reported some activity there earlier in the day. The report had only said that in the middle of the night, a group had been seen on infrascreens entering the compound area, and that the group had vanished, leaving only the usual sprawled about and apparently asleep night guards. The scanners of the orbiting combined force were now picking up something unusual down there on the approaching horizon. There seemed to be a more than normal number of people at the site. There was a local snowstorm in progress down there, and infra beams were a bit blurred. The attention of the combined force was not yet fixed on the compound as it shortly would be. the command network of view screens was occupied by an interview that was going on. When Half-Captain Rogo Dieter Snaul had gone back to Tallnep for reinforcements, he had contacted his uncle, Quarter Admiral Snaulieder. Rogo Dieter believed in keeping profit in the family. The Quarter Admiral had come along gladly with a flotilla of 5 ships, the largest of which was the Terrify-class battle plane launching capital ship Capture. Snaulieder had not become a Quarter Admiral without some skill, and he had brought part of that skill with him, a reporter. Ruf Arsebager considered himself the ace reporter of the Tallnep Midnight Fang. Even among news media of other systems, the Fang was envied as the very epitome of inaccuracy, corruption, and biased news. It always printed exactly what the government wanted, even while pretending to be anti-government. And Ruf Arsebager enjoyed the reputation of being the most poisonous reporter on a staff that specialized in them. The interview was being conducted by Arsebager on the Capture and was addressed to Half-Captain Rogo Dieter Snaul. It was just a background interview and things were dull, so others were listening in. They had various opinions. The Quarter Admiral was not well liked. Other commanders contested Snaulieder's contention that he was the senior commander and therefore the head of the combined force, and that he was the uncle of the even less popular Rogo Dieter Snaul made him even less acceptable. They detested Snaul.
"Now, getting back to the man on this counterfeit one-credit banknote," Arsebager was saying, "would you say that he was dishonest?"
"Oh, worse," replied Snaul.
"Would the description, he is a known pervert, fit him?"
"Oh, worse," replied Snaul.
"Good, good," said Arsebager. "We must keep this to a totally factual interview, you understand. How would he steals babies and drinks their blood do?"
"Fine, fine," said Snaul. "Exactly."
"I think you mentioned," said Arsebager, "when you filed dispatches, that you had several times met this... what is his name? This defiler of established governments? Tyler?" "Yes, that you met him in personal combat."
Other commanders were hearing this, and Rogo Dieter had not thought it would become public property. He had reckoned without the publicity hunger of his uncle.
"Not exactly," said Rogo Dieter quickly. "I meant to say that I tried, but he always ran away."
Quarter Admiral Snaulieder's voice came from the background behind Arsebager.
"But he won't get away again." "Now, in your opinion, Rogo Dieter, do you truly think this is the one?"
The small gray man had been watching all this on his view screens. He detested reporters, and this Ruf Arsebager had earned his particular dislike. The reporter's fangs were stained nearly black, there were blotches of some disease on his face, and one could almost smell his unwashed condition over the view screen. Unfortunately or fortunately, whichever way you looked at it, his couriership had come in just yesterday. It had brought lots of odds and ends, but among them was the clear-cut statement that the one had not been found. Along with that, there was a prize edition. The 100 million credits originally offered by the Hauven Interrelated Confederation of Systems had been doubled by the Bulbod Equality Empire. The small gray man did not know what was going on in other sectors, much less other universes, but he could suppose that the same mad scramble was in progress. The courier dispatch box contents, when viewed as a whole, said that these were indeed very strange and troublesome times, that a problem like this had not existed in any past history they were aware of. And there had been some hints about the vital necessity of his presence where he could do some good, instead of out here sailing around a 12th-rate Rimstars-only planet. There was no direct criticism, of course. There were just hints and undertone. But actually, it would not matter whether he were home or not. Unless some solution presented itself, the chaos that was going to ensue would be so vast that neither he nor others could hope to control it. He was going on listening absently to this asinine reporter interview an asinine military mind when his bridge buzzer sounded and his watch officer's face appeared on the screen.
Your Excellency, said the watch officer, there is something going on down in that capital city area. The infra beams are scrambling. We cannot tell what is happening. There are no clear pictures.
The interview cut off suddenly. Other commanders seemed to have noticed it. The Hockner commander appeared on the small gray man's screen.
Your Excellency, I believe you said that was the central seat of government. We are getting pictures of massed troops and recordings of excessive heat. In your opinion, is this political?
The small gray man looked at his own screens of the area. Bad as they had been before due to a local storm, they were incredibly bad now. One couldn't make out a thing. Some sort of interference was blasting them off the air. Wait. That jagged traveling line on the screen. A teleportation trace. Hastily, the small gray man thought of an answer. I believe, he said conservatively to the Hockner, that it is probably political in some connected way. All the information that... His screens almost caved in. There was a tremendous flare, then nothing. A squawk horn was going. Screen overload! Screen overload! Good heavens! You never got that except in a major battle area. The small gray man rushed to his port as he knew the commanders must be doing. He stared down. There was a babble of incredulity on the remaining voice channels from the other ships.